This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As December snows fall, weekend warriors from all over New England will pack up the car, strap the skis to the roof, and hit the slopes for a fairly expensive getaway. But in some places, skiing is a strategy for staying alive. Mark Jenkins, a contributing writer for National Geographic, traveled to the northernmost fringe of Western China, where skiing was invented many millennia ago. He spoke with the people who carry on their earliest skiing traditions, using the same resources and methods as their ancestors. Mark Jenkins joined us last December to talk about his trip and his article, On the Trail with the First Skiers. Mark, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Where the first skiers came from is a matter of some debate. So could you fill us in first on that discussion and competing evidence of first humans on skis?
Sure. Well, it all comes from snowy countries, as you would expect. The competitors are Norway, Finland, Sweden, Russia, and China. And China is the most recent to start to claim that they were the first to ski. They have now found petroglyphs of skiers chasing ibex in northern Altai in China that date to 3,000 to 5,000 years old. But of course, the Russians have found an actual ski tip that is 8,000 years old. So there's kind of a bit of a battle of who was the first to ski. My sense of it is that it might have been a simultaneous adventure all across the North Country because they learned to ski to hunt.
You went to this remote hamlet, Okoram, is that how we say it?
Okoram, yeah.
Okoram, yep. Mountains in northwestern China, Central Asia, really. We're lucky enough to witness people using the age-old process of making skis. Can you tell us about the process?
Sure. It was extraordinarily simple in some ways. I mean, they all carry an axe, and they just ski out. You've got probably 5 feet of powder. It's incredibly light snow. It's champagne powder. This is a continental climate, so there's very little precipitation. Ski out, find a tree, a red spruce. They'll spend all morning looking for the straightest tree with the straightest grain. They'll cut it down. They'll make a chunk that's about 7 feet long. They'll split that in half. It's so cold, it's usually 20 to 40 below zero every day, that they just score the trunk down the middle, and with a swing of the axe, they split the tree in half. And then they basically axe it down to these two kind of look 2x4 looking things. They carry it back to their shed, their horse barn, and then they whittle it down with an axe, put it in a pot to bend, to heat up the tips and bend them, put the bent tips in a jig, hold it for about 10 days like that, and then they nail horsehair the full length of the bottom of the ski, so it glides forward very easily, but catches. It's kind of like the fur of a cat, you know, if you run your hand one way, if you run your hand the other way. And that's how they're able to climb up and down mountains so easily. They don't use wax on the bottom. It's horsehair.
How about the technique of actually operating the skis? One pole, you use kind of like a rudder. How did they do that? How fast can you go, and how much control would you have?
That's a good question. They have far more control than you would imagine. Now, the problem, again, is that the snow is so light that I was on telemark skis, and I had this standard two-pole system. And even with a fairly large basket, for those in New Hampshire, you call a powder basket on the end of your pole, it would sink straight down to your hands in the snow. The tayak, or the pole that they have, is about 6 to 8 feet long. So they use that to push themselves forward, and when they're going downhill, they use it as a rudder. They put it kind of along the side and drop the tail in with their hands, and that's the way they're able to turn. Now, the bindings are incredibly simple. They are just an X strap of leather, and there's a hole drilled, four holes drilled into the ski, and then they have leather straps coming up, and they just put a snow boot in there. So they're not tight, and your heel can slide off very easily. So it takes a lot of skill. I got on these skis and tried to do what they can do, and obviously I need several generations of practice to be able to do it. They even jump these skis.
There's a chart here of comparing different skis from different eras. These look, I guess, a little shorter, a little thicker, maybe more like Telmark skis. The people that live in this region also have an interesting lineage, a kind of mix, almost stuck in the middle of several different countries and cultures. Can you tell us a little bit about the people who live there?
Sure. Although we were in China, the tribes people we were with are Tuvans. And they feel like they're direct descendants of Genghis Khan. In fact, when you go into everyone's home, there's a picture of Genghis Khan. And they even shave the kid's head with just this little black tuft of hair. So they see themselves as descendants of Genghis Khan. They are a Siberian/Mongolian people, largely pastoralists. They raise horses and they eat horses. And during the winter, they hunt on skis. They hunt elk.
Which language do they speak?
They speak Tuvan, which is this kind of, it's actually a variation of Turkish, which is remarkable.
Like the throat singers, the Tuvan throat singers?
That's right. That's right. These are the same people, the throat singers. I tried to get some of them, when we were out on this long, multiple-day elk hunt, I tried to get some of them to throat sing, and they couldn't do it, but they did put on some Tuvan rap for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, you have to imagine the scene here, because the snow is about 5 feet deep, and what they've done is they've cut down actual trees and dragged them down. These are dead trees, obviously, and made a bonfire that would make the Boy Scouts proud. I mean, it burned a hole 4 feet down to the ground. And so we're kind of in this enclosed wall, the snow melting, and they're singing songs, and then suddenly they get kind of bored with their traditional songs and just put on a smartphone with a couple of little speakers. And now we're skiing. We just crossed elk tracks. We've crossed wolf tracks. And these guys are incredibly tough. I mean, they just put an army blanket over them and slept through the night. They all pile in one pile, and it was literally 40 below. I had my Everest sleeping bag with me.
Wow. Tell us about that hunt, which was actually more of a trekking expedition, because I guess hunting is really restricted in China.
Hunting's illegal and owning a firearm is illegal, but that doesn't really matter because they have a different tradition there.
Huh.
We set out, half dozen of us. We crossed elk tracks several times, and on the third day, we actually came in contact with two bulls, which obviously ran off, and so we tracked those bulls. Now, when they got close enough, they saw them down in the valley. They just jump onto their skis and go straight down. I mean, none of this big slalom turns and things like that. They basically ski, 30 miles an hour straight down. And the amazing part is they're going to lasso these elk.
So what? On the skis?
On the skis. You're skiing down, and they've got a rawhide lasso. Imagine this. This is a cowboy skier, right? And this loop in the lasso has to go over the antlers of an elk. So it's about 6 to 8 feet wide, the loop, and they're screaming. Then they fall backwards and catch the elk, and their skis are perpendicular to the elk. And, of course, the elk, remember, it's such light snow that the elk are almost already swimming.
Mm-hmm.
They're swimming in the snow, and they start to fight. They struggle against the rope. The skiers, the Tuvan skiers, are actually kind of just dragged through the snow, and this will go on for 2 or 3 hours until the elk is exhausted. It's kind of old men in the sea sort of thing.
What a scene.
It's fantastic, yeah. And it's been going on for thousands of years. No matter what you believe, where the oldest skiing and ski culture is, it's certainly 3,000 to 4,000 years old, this same technique. But they can't kill the animals. So they actually took myself and the photographer out just to show them that they still had all these skills and they still could do this.
Well, you and the photographer were there. Do you think if you hadn't been there, they would have killed the elk?
Yeah, it's hard to question. I think they may have, although they have a very successful herd of horses, and they eat horse meat all the time. That's what we survived on, was horse meat. So I don't know if they need the meat that much, but they love the hunt.
I think Mark, many of us have seen those photographs of mountains, glacial basins where snow and ice has receded, ascribed to climate change.
Right.
Has that changed snow levels or anything about the lifestyle of the people that you saw?
It has. The Altai, like all places, I was on Everest last year, it's also lost an enormous amount of snow. Same here. This is the first time in the last 4 years that they've been able to ski well enough to actually track elk. Formerly, 50 years ago, I interviewed a lot of the old guys who were 75, 80. You know, every winter there was 5, 6, 7 feet of snow. So the elk are kind of stranded. They're just, you know, cutting troughs. And so hunting elk was not that difficult. Now, unless you have a heavy snow year, you can't hunt them at all because they'll just leave.
That was our earlier conversation with Mark Jenkins, contributing writer for National Geographic. He rode on the trail with the world's first skiers for the December 2013 issue. You'll find a link to read the article, a slideshow of photos, and stunning video of the skiers in action at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As kids, we're told not to talk to strangers. As adults, many of us still abide by that rule. It's made easier with headphones in our ears as we walk down the street, touch screens to focus on in the checkout line, and an easy pass to zip through the tolls. With tools that promote social isolation, are we missing out on human interactions that could surprise or delight us? Talking to strangers may be good for your health, says Elizabeth Dunn, an associate professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. Earlier this year, she joined us to talk about Hello, Stranger. That's an article she wrote for the New York Times. We started our conversation by talking about a study that examined strangers' behavior on public transportation. So a good place to start researching strangers is on public transportation, where everyone is a stranger, surrounded by a stranger. And the unwritten rule pretty much seems to be keep your head down, keep to yourself. Now, you found a study that challenged that rule. Can you explain it?
Sure thing. Researchers at the University of Chicago headed out to a busy train station in the Chicago area, and they asked commuters to either just kind of keep to themselves, sit in solitude, as so many of us often do, or to mix things up a little bit and actually talk to the stranger sitting next to them during their train ride that morning. And what they found was that people were significantly happier at the end of their train ride if they actually took the time to talk to the person sitting next to them rather than sitting in solitude.
So people were willing to talk back with them?
Yeah, and that's one of the surprising things. I think many of us feel like, you know, the people around us who are immersed in their smartphones or reading the paper don't want to talk. But interestingly, not a single person in the study was snubbed in their attempt to make conversation.
How about on airplanes? I mean, I'm probably not the first person who's noticed that somebody sort of rolls their eyeballs when they think they've got an empty seat next to them. Suddenly someone's sitting with them. And you don't necessarily want to engage in conversation because it might have to last for 6 hours worth of flight.
Right. I mean, I remember quite distinctly one time I was on a plane and there was no one sitting next to me. I had a lot of work to do. And then this huge guy got on and came over and sat next to me and proceeded to spend the entire time talking to me on this flight. But he actually turned out to be an ultimate fighter. And it was one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had with a person that I normally would never, ever encountered in my daily life. So I think even when we don't feel inclined to talk to somebody sitting nearby us, it can actually result in, really positive experience.
Well, okay, then we're moving on from commuters to relationships, which you're talking about, more specifically your own. Now, you did an experiment with your boyfriend, Benjamin. What can you tell us about that?
Well, when I was a graduate student, I noticed that my boyfriend, Ben, would sometimes get in a little bit of a bad mood. And if he was around me, he would just kind of act cranky, knowing that I, as his longtime girlfriend, would put up with his negative mood. But if we happened to bump into a stranger or casual acquaintance, Benjamin would perk right up and he'd act pleasant and cheerful, as you have to, around someone you don't know well. And what I noticed was that acting pleasant around someone he didn't know well often got him out of his bad mood. So, you know, one person does not make an experiment, but it did provide the inspiration. And so I decided to bring dozens of long-term romantic couples into the lab. And what I found is that most people show this Benjamin effect, whereby they'll act more pleasant around someone they don't know, have never met, compared to how they act around their own romantic partner.
Well, I guess what the Benjamin effect says is that strangers, not necessarily the people closest to us, can perk us up. This is something one of your students, Jillian Sandstrom, tested. Can you tell us a little bit about her study?
So my student Jillian had the insight that the sort of random players, the bit players in our daily lives, might actually matter quite a bit for our happiness. So to get at this, my student and I gave people two little clickers to carry around with them all day, one red, one black. They clicked the red clicker when they interacted with someone they didn't know well. They clicked the black clicker when they interacted with someone they did know well, someone close to them. And then at the end of the day, they just reported the numbers on their two clickers as well as completing some measures of happiness. What we found was that, as you'd expect, people felt happier on days when they had lots of interactions with people they were close to. But more surprisingly, people also felt happier on days when they had more interactions with people they didn't know well. And in fact, the strengths of those effects were very similar. So people got just as much of a happiness boost from interacting with those they didn't know well as they did from interacting with people close to them.
Very interesting. And you and Jillian tested that again at Starbucks. Tell us about that further study.
Well, we conducted a study at a busy urban Starbucks. We went up to people just as they were approaching, and we told some people to try to really have a social interaction with the cashier at Starbucks, to smile, make eye contact, have a little bit of conversation. And we told other people, just be efficient. You know, get in, get out, get your coffee. That's it. Try to avoid unnecessary conversation. And then on people's way out from Starbucks, we measured their happiness and their sense of belonging. Now, you might think interacting with the cashier at Starbucks, that's pretty trivial. It's not going to have any impact on well-being. But in fact, we found that people were significantly happier when they came out of Starbucks if they'd taken the time to have that little social interaction with the cashier. And perhaps even more remarkably, they felt a greater sense of belonging in their communities when they took the time to have that little interaction rather than just getting in and getting out with their coffee.
So maybe not as efficient, but better.
Right. And interestingly, I mean, I'm one of these people for sure who rushes from one thing to the next. I love efficiency. It's sort of the title of our article is Efficiency Overrated? And it's almost a joke between me and my graduate student because I am all about efficiency. Like I schedule meetings back to back. I rush in and out with my coffee. But in fact, what this research suggests is that, saving those few extra seconds by cutting out a social interaction may be a bad trade-off when it comes to our happiness.
Elizabeth Dunn is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's been studying talking to strangers and interacting with strangers and what it actually does for us. It turns out pretty good. How about introverts versus extroverts? Does any of the research you looked at apply to both types of people?
I think many people have the intuition that for extroverts, social interactions are good. And sure, if you're extroverted, then interacting with, the barista at Starbucks or the random guy at the dog park is going to make you happy. But introverts sometimes say to us, well, it's a different story for me. Those social interactions are too taxing for me. They don't make me happy. I'd rather keep to myself. One of the fascinating findings in our research is that when we asked people to carry clickers around all day and keep track of their social interactions, we found that introverts and extroverts alike felt happier on days when they had more social interactions with people they didn't know very well. So this suggests that introverts might actually underestimate the benefits that they really get from interacting with other people.
And it doesn't even require a conversation. It can be just a look.
As little as a sort of fleeting glance seems to make a difference for people's well-being. In a fascinating study, researchers on a large Midwestern campus sent a college-aged woman around campus, and she either made eye contact with people she passed or looked past them as though she was looking through air, sort of as though they weren't there. Mm-hmm. And then researchers trailed her and asked the people who'd been passed by this woman how they were feeling. And in fact, this fleeting glance actually made a difference. So people were more likely to feel disconnected from others if someone, this random stranger, had passed them and looked through them as though they were air. So just that quick glance that we give to strangers, that tiny bit of sort of civil respect actually seems to make a difference for the well-being of those around us.
But it does sometimes cross a line, interactions with passersby, where people can turn into sort of feeling predatory or creepy. Do you have any advice on how to keep these little street corner interactions or subway interactions positive?
There is certainly such a thing as a creepy stranger. So, in fact, in one classic study from back in the 70s, researchers planted somebody on a street corner who actually stared at motorists, and motorists left the intersection very quickly in that version of the study. So staring at strangers is not a good idea. You know, probably asking people very personal questions isn't a great idea. But, you know, making that little comment about the weather or complimenting someone's shoes or, you know, when you're in the dog park, asking what kind of dog someone has, all of these sorts of things are all very much within the realm of sort of socially acceptable behavior among strangers and can contribute to enhancing people's days.
How about you, Elizabeth, the efficient professor, you know, writing books, writing articles, doing all sorts of things. What have you taken away from the studies? Have you started chatting up strangers?
This research has definitely influenced me. So my graduate student, Jillian Sandstrom, is a hugger. She, like, hugs everyone that she sees. I mean, not people she's never met before, but she'll hug, like, all the people in our department. I am still not a hugger, so it hasn't completely transformed me. But I do think about it. If I'm in a, you know, new city and I'm taking a cab to my hotel, I try to, you know, make a little conversation with the cab driver. And sometimes I end up having an interesting conversation. Sometimes it just, you know, gives me a brief smile. But I do try to adjust my behavior, at least in little tiny ways, to kind of put this research into practice and connect with strangers.
Well, I'm so glad you spoke with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was our earlier conversation with Elizabeth Dunn, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's also the author of Happy Money, the Science of Smarter Spending.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are some things in life you simply cannot plan for, like what happens when you develop a debilitating chronic illness in the prime of your life. You can't control how the disease will affect your career, your family, your dreams. This is the story of one such person who had little choice but to become a medical guinea pig to keep her disease at bay. We'll travel with her as she makes a pilgrimage to the best doctor in the world for her condition. So how did NHPR reporter Jack Rodolico get such close access? The patient is his wife.
Christina sits on the edge of our bed with a needle hovering over her thigh.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
That one hurt.
The pain of that shot, it's nothing compared with the pain Christina would feel without the medication she needs for her illness. Doctors have thrown everything at Christina's Crohn's disease, and still, it has run amok. At her sickest, she had more than 30 bowel movements a day.
I grew up in a household where poop and fart jokes were just funny. You know, it wasn't taboo. So I guess for the first time having Crohn's, like, poop suddenly didn't become funny.
It has a very private side to it. Most people really suffer alone.
To answer the question of what she has suffered, it's unimaginable. How she has handled it is what's more remarkable.
Dr. Daniel Popowich is a surgeon at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City who has treated Christina. Crohn's disease sends the immune system on a kamikaze mission, attacking the gut. When Christina first got sick, her inflammation was isolated to her large intestine, also called the colon. And essentially, the disease killed her colon.
Well, my impression in the operating room when I met her is, wow, this is a very sick patient. We were all very concerned about her at that moment.
The surgeons replaced her colon with what's called a J-pouch. A J-pouch is made of the last foot of the patient's small intestine. Surgeons reroute it so it looks like a catch drain under a sink, then reconnect it to the anus.
Christina?
That surgery was 4 years ago, and since then, Crohn's disease has manifested directly in Christina's J-pouch. That's rare. And now her gastroenterologist, Corey Siegel at Dartmouth Hitchcock in New Hampshire, thinks Christina needs to double her drug dose.
So
Humira one shot a week now, is that right?
So I didn't increase it yet, so we got the approval. It
took in front of the doctors, Christina keeps it together. But when we walk away, she releases the emotions behind that mask.
I try now not to make any decisions out of fear, but it's hard because sometimes I feel like it's all about fear. I take the medication because I'm afraid of what I know will happen when I don't take it. And then I'm afraid to take the medication because of all the potential unknowns.
Given how complicated Christina's condition is, that is active Crohn's disease in the J-pouch, it was really only a matter of time before we were referred to the specialist of specialists, a guy his patients call J-pouch Jesus.
Welcome to Cleveland, ladies and gentlemen. The local time is approximately 11:40.
I'm looking for desk A30.
You gotta take these elevators in the center.
Dr. Bo Shen works at the Cleveland Clinic. He only treats patients with problem J-pouches.
Hello, how are you doing, Christina? How are you doing?
Nice.
Thanks for coming.
Have
a seat. Yeah.
Science is essentially all about seeing patterns and placing things into categories. Outliers like Christina are confusing when isolated, but after just a few questions, I can tell Dr. Shen has seen patients like Christina before.
Christina, label your quality of life. Say that 10 would be the best, 0 is worst. Now.
Well, it's a little hard to say because I feel like I came from being so sick that I feel so lucky to be alive.
But sick people get used to sickness. You don't know what the real good life should be. At your standard, 15 years ago, your quality of life is 10. And then now compare. Now, what's your quality of life now?
I guess it's a 6.
Okay. People without Humira, what's your quality of life?
1.
You have a pouch here.
After an exam under anesthesia, Dr. Shen says we have to get the inflammation in Christina's J-pouch under control. If not, she will live with an ostomy bag. That's a bag hanging from her belly that her intestine will pour into. But Dr. Shen also tells us something mind-boggling. So the drugs that treat Crohn's suppress the immune system, which stops it from attacking the gut. But Dr. Shen says there's a medication that does the opposite. It boosts the immune system, and that can suppress the disease too.
So we present our data about 2 years ago in the national meeting. We have a success rate at the time is 50%. So
whether this medicine works or not, it's a sign there are new treatments coming. When you live with chronic illness, you measure your victories in possibilities, not big wins.
Thank you.
You very much.
Thank you. We always remain available to you guys.
Thank you. It's after 11 o'clock. We have to wake up at 4:30 to get on a plane to go back home. I don't really know how this trip is going to change us, if at all. This is Crohn's disease. It's so ambiguous. But keep pushing through.
Back home in New Hampshire, Christina and I walk on the snow-coated pond outside our home to calm down. In the coming months, Christina would become a medical guinea pig. First, she took a dose of the immune-boosting drug.
And now we hope for the best.
But that same week, she had to go to the hospital twice. It felt too risky to try something so new, so she took the other risk and suppressed her immune system even more.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The drugs got her feeling much better, but not perfect. And then her doctor recommended something really experimental, something very safe, and something that's only been tried on 1,000 or so patients with inflammatory bowel disease. Christina went into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, a glass tube filled with 100% oxygen under pressure, every day, Monday to Friday, for 2 months.
It's day 32 of 40 days of treatment. I feel like it's a bit biblical.
Biblical is not a bad word for it. All that oxygen flowed into her lungs, meshed with her blood, and traveled to her J pouch, healing it. Mostly. For now.
Feels warmer.
Yeah.
Right?
Won't stay cold forever.
I'd like to say we're hopeful science is on the verge of catching up with Christina's disease, but the truth is, we don't know where we'll be next year or the year after. These days, we try to look to each other, not science, for hope.
And that story from NHPR's health reporter Jack Rodolico. It's part of the PRX STEM Story Project made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.